On this episode of Faith and Fame, I'm joined by Dutch Bradley, a motivational speaker, life coach, producer, and an ex-felon. Growing up, Dutch Bradley was filled with anger and loneliness in his heart, and as he grew older, these emotions carried him from despondent child to a street thug. Machine guns and saran wrap crack cocaine with bruised knuckles set the background for his life. But as street peddling drugs turned into a drug enterprise, his lifestyle got caught up. A simple traffic stop turned into a gun to his head and a hogtie on the interstate, and suddenly, Dutch Bradley was faced with decades in prison and a lifetime away from his family. Tune in to discover how Dutch Bradley turned his life around and is now a speaker and an advocate for the prison reform. This is Faith and Fame with Brittany Q. Hill. Stay tuned. Thank you for joining an episode of Faith and Fame. How are you?
Absolutely. It is a privilege and an honor. So thank you, Brittany Q. Hill.
Of course. So I want to jump right in because from what I know about you thus far, your story, I believe, is one that we can all relate to at some point in our lives. It's a story about endurance, perseverance, and really standing on the promises of God. But before we do that, let me formally introduce you. Dutch Bradley is a motivational speaker, life coach, producer, a father, and an ex-felon who's now using his platform to contribute to the prison reform. So before we get into your work with the prison reform, let's start off by you taking us on your journey. So I would like to know from the beginning how you got to where you are now.
Wow. Okay. Wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity. You know, my memory goes back to being raised with a stepfather who pretty much would introduce his children as these are my boys. And that over there, that's Linda's son. And I just remember the rejection and how I had to deal with that rejection because I wanted nothing more than to be loved by my stepfather. I wanted to be part of the family. I didn't want to be a stepchild. I wanted to belong to him. And so rejection impacted me very early and very deeply. And the result of it was a lot of anger. Now, it's because of that rejection that it came to my mind that I've never met my real father. It was never a thought to me prior to that. But not only am I being rejected, but my real father is nowhere in the picture. So there's no affirmation coming from any male figure in my life at all. There's no correction. There's no reproof. There's no love. There's no embrace. There's no touch. So my identification with male as leaders or within leadership or within a power structure became something that that I didn't settle with very easily, and that'll make more sense as I proceed with the story. But I dealt with the anger through having an amazing athletic gift. I was all state in football, basketball. I also did track and field, and so I had a lot of accolade that came from that, which was wonderful. I was on the front page of newspapers. I was very popular. I was very, very well known. And after my junior year of high school, I transferred and I went to a larger school. And when I did, the former school, their principal, who was a male figure that I looked up to, and the basketball coach from the former school, they reported me to the state board saying that my move was illegal, which it was. I moved for athletic reasons. It was on the back end of my mother and my stepfather getting divorced in a very terrible divorce. They were both in infidelity, both having extramarital relationships. My father, my stepfather initiated that, but in response to it and in response to the rejection and the hurt, my mother would then go and do the same thing. And so I had to be emancipated by the courts to move away from them, to go to high school about 30 miles away from where I was. And when I did that, I had to go in front of the state board. The state board then declared me ineligible to play sports my senior year of high school. Devastated me. The only thing that I had going for me in my life was sports. It was my complete and total identity. And so this created a great outpouring of anger for me. And I appealed it, and the appeal would not get me approved to be able to play football, but it did approve me midway through the basketball season to be able to play. But by this time, all of my scholarships had basically went away because I was now identified as this young high school athlete with all this tremendous ability, but I came with all of these problems. And so Division I schools that were there my junior year were not there at the end of my senior year. And so I ended up getting involved in the cocaine and the crack game at that time. And I grew up in the Northeast, so for us to go into New York specifically, I would go into Harlem. And for those of you that cannot tell, I'm a white guy, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy, going into Spanish Harlem in New York City, where nobody looks like me. Most of the people don't even speak English. And I'm going in with a bag full of money, picking up larger and larger quantities of cocaine. And I began trafficking it from New York City down to Atlanta, Georgia. And I had a network all the way back up the coast. But I was still an athlete. And so I would revisit college. I went to a JUCO. I averaged 25 points a game in basketball when I returned to play there. Our team was 11-0, and incredibly enough, I just left school. I left school because it was less challenging for me at that JUCO than it was at the level of sports that I was playing in high school. And so I pretty much just became disenchanted with that lifestyle. And it's around this time that my girlfriend becomes pregnant, and she tells me that we're going to have a son. And I am really devastated because I'm not ready to be a father. I'm trying to figure out, you know, what I'm doing in life. And long story short, it was really, if I'm going to be truthful, it was something that I wanted to run away from, mm-hmm. not because I didn't care for or love the child, but because that is what my father and my stepfather did to me. Mm-hmm. So I was pushed away. It's, you know, it's biblically called iniquity. It is this thing that falls up from the father upon their children, and it goes for generations. And the beauty of it was that when my son was born, I was right there. And if anyone questions that, just ask his grandmother, because she was punching me the entire time. she kept yelling at me because it was a difficult birthing, and she kept asking me why I had to be so big. Why are you so big?
Oh, that's funny.
And the long and the short of it is that when my son was born, I just could not hold back the tears. There was such an overwhelming joy with everything that had gone wrong in my life. This was something that, even though I didn't do it the right way, this was something good. This was something that I could have, that no one could take it away from me. This is my child. I love him. I made him promises. I remember as early as the birthing room, telling him, son, I will never leave you. I will always be here for you. I am going to affirm you with my mouth. I am going to kiss you with my lips. I'm going to give you all of the things that I wish that I had received from a father growing up, and I didn't. And the problem was I was in the cocaine game. And with that, I was making promises with my mouth that my lifestyle couldn't cash. Because I got arrested really a total of 9 times. It came with very early arrests with things like traffic violations, where I ended up getting my license suspended for 18 years, my driver's license for 18 years, because I was under criminal investigation by the DEA. They would get me with repetitive pullover for driving and driving without a license. And so that was kind of the way that they began tracking me. And then ultimately I got 3 major arrests. I had a 1-2 on a handgun with cocaine paraphernalia. I had a 12-24 with a grand jury indictment where 4 men were testifying against me. And then lastly, I had a 25-40 for cocaine trafficking, where I literally got pulled over muling my own packages on an interstate, where I had flown from New York to Atlanta, and I was driving back through in North Carolina and meeting some friends at a university there to party. And I got snagged on the interstate. They pulled me into a jail cell, and that's when I called home to the one person, the only person that always had my back and always took my phone calls, and that was my mom. And I just remember when my mother answered the phone at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, a mom knows that their child's in trouble when they call at that time. Mm-hmm. And she just said, son, what's wrong? And I remember just saying, mom, they got me. I'm going to prison for sure this time. And I just want to let you know that I'm sorry and that I love you. And when I hung up the phone with my mother, and it still touches me. She tells me that she looked up into heaven and she said 8 words. She said, God, if you exist, will you please help my boy? And this is so profound because we're not a religious family. We didn't grow up attending any type of church or any other major religion. And my mother is crying out because my mother saved me from all of the criticism because of how I was rejected as a boy by my real father and by my stepfather. She would always step up and have my back because she felt badly for me that no man was there. And because she saved me out of everything, God could never save me until she finally gave me to the only one that could.
Mm-hmm.
She reached out when she cried out to God. I can almost, every time I share or think of this story, I just think how the Father must have just gotten this humongous smile on his face when she reached out and gave me to him. And I know that it was a relief for him. I know that it was a relief for her. And it began the start of something really incredible because you would think that then the angels would have floated into my prison cell and serenaded me because of my mother's prayer, but that's not the way it was carried out. The next day I woke up and there was a man who was really up all night screaming and yelling. He had a lunatic spirit is what I would call it. He was definitely being terrorized himself. And the next morning I woke up, he attacked me from behind.
Oh, wow.
And when he did, I turned around and I was very angry and I was used to violence. And so I snapped off my food tray on his head into the wall of the jail. And when that happened, the guards ran in, they separated us and they sent him to lockup and they asked me if I wanted to go to church, which, you know, any two inmates that get into a fight, they're both supposed to be detained.
Mm-hmm.
And they're giving me this option, maybe because I just came in the night before. But I remember turning and saying, I don't want to go to no effing church. I mean, I don't want to go to church.
Right. Right.
I'm looking at 38 years in prison. I just got into a fist fight the first night, you know, in the jail. And the last thing I want to do is go to church. And
mm-hmm.
then pack up your bags. You're going to lock up. I said, lock up? I said, man, hold the door. I'm going to church.
No, that's right.
So, you know, church was, it was a 6x9 prison cell. It wasn't, it didn't have granite floors. It didn't have a steeple. It didn't have a cross anywhere. It was a 6x9 prison cell. There was one other guy who was in there with me. He was African-American. He was probably about 15 years older than me. And we kind of sat there together and we watched this little chubby fella turn the corner with his pocket square with 8 pens in it and his button-up shirt. And he kind of shuffled across the floor. And when he got there, he delivered his little sermonette that morning that I don't recall any of it. And then he reached through the prison bars and he said 8 words to me that were very impactful. He handed me a small brown book called A Gideon Bible. And his 8 words were, you look burdened, can I pray for you? And the reason that this is so powerful and it's so amazing for me is that I had a real problem with men. Because in order for me to get the affection or the affirmation of men, I always had to perform. You know, whether it was athletics, whether it was doing chores around the house, no matter what it was, in order for me to get any type of affirmation, I had to perform, and here I am in jail looking at 38 years in prison, and I can't perform.
Mm.
And this man is giving me something, and he's not charging me a thing for it. And the difference was he had quoted a bunch of scriptures initially that I didn't have the ability to retain or understand, but then he cared for me, and it was caring for me that brought me to a place of where I was able to receive some help. And so we prayed the prayer, and the only thing I remember was it ended in Jesus' name. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as we walked away from there, it was only about 10, no more than 15 minutes. The other gentleman that was in there with me, Andrew Kirkman, he was doing a life sentence for drug kingpin charges. And he looked at me and he asked me if I had any children. And I mentioned that I had a newborn son at home. And I cried, Brittany, for the first time in years.
Wow.
Because I knew I had made my son promises. And I didn't want my little boy to grow up angry with his daddy the way I grew up angry with mine. And I knew that if I went away and did all of this prison time, that my son was going to wonder why I wasn't there for him. I ran quickly from that conversation, and I called home, and I spoke to my son's mother, and I said, I just gave my life to God. And she said, you did what? And I said, listen, I just prayed, and I asked God for help. And she's like, okay.
Right.
And you know, then obviously I asked to speak with my little boy at the time, who was, you know, a Gerber baby, I'm sorry. And there wasn't a whole lot he could say, but just hearing him in the background was such a compelling and motivating thing for me. And so what I'd like to share is this, is that I did not pray that prayer because I was afraid of doing 38 years in prison. 38 years is a lot of time. It's overwhelming. And it was the straw that broke my back. But the reason I prayed that prayer is because God used someone that I loved more than myself, which was my little boy. And he used my love for that little boy to ask for help so that I could be a better daddy, so that I could be a better man, that hopefully one day I will be a better husband. And I used that time while I was in jail and prison to bring correction to my life and to help me grow up and become a better man. Now, here's the last part of this, and then I'll hand this back over to you, is when I went in the chain gang, they hooked me up to about 40 other inmates, and we had to shuffle from the jail with foot irons on across the underground to go to the courthouse. And I just remember shuffling across there and thinking to myself, how in the world did I get myself into this? Like, how did I get into this outcome? I could always get myself out of everything. And when we sat in the courthouse, the other guys that were chained up to me, the judge would call their names, and they were looking at 3 months. They were looking at time served. They were looking at 6 months. And then they called my name, and they said that I had, in that particular state, I was looking at 25 to 40 years in prison. And I remember hearing the men chained up to me saying, man, what did you do? And it really hit me for the first time that I could be going away and my son will never know me growing up. And it impacted me very, very deeply. Long story short, the only thing I asked God for was not justice. I said, Lord, I'm not asking you for justice, but I'm crying out to you for mercy. Please be merciful to me. And the long story short is, and it would take a whole nother show, with 38 years hanging over my head, I had charges, three different sets of charges. God did nothing but miracle after miracle to knock my time down. And if you want to talk about that, we can. But it's just incredible how God responded to my faith as a 22-year-old man with a 1.5-year-old son, and how he lined everything up so that love, here's the beauty of it. Because I loved my son, I didn't love God. But he used my love for my son until I could love God.
Wow.
And now I love God. And because I love God, I have a greater ability to love my son.
Wow. That'll preach all by itself.
Yeah. God
wow.
is good.
So how much time did you end up serving?
So I ended up doing a total of 2.5 years in prison.
Wow.
Yeah. Real quick, you know, there's details behind this, but the 1 to 2 I got sentenced, I went and I did 4 to 23 months. The 12 to 24 grand jury indictment, God spoke to me. I was reading the word of God. I was praying. I was making these adjustments and changes in my life. And I came to Luke 12:12. I had court the next day. I was very anxious. And while I read it, it says, do not worry what you say when you enter the courtroom, for it will not be you who is speaking, but the Holy Spirit will speak through you.
Mm.
And I said, man, this book was written thousands of years ago. And it's telling me how to conduct myself. And so when I went into the courtroom the next day, my attorney had already lined up a plea agreement with the DA and with the judge. They were going to plead me guilty. If they did it that way, they would run my charges 12 to 24 concurrent with 25 to 40. And if I took it to trial, then they would not run them concurrent, but they would stack the charges on top of one another. So when I got in court, the judge has me stand up, and when he asked me how I plead, I stand up and I plead not guilty, Your Honor. And the DA and my attorney looked at each other. My attorney looked at me, and then they went to the back room. They had a discussion. About 10 minutes later, they came back out on the courtroom floor, and my attorney looks at me and says, "Man, I don't know what you've done, but God is on your side."
Wow.
He said, because the DA is no longer going to file or take you to trial on these charges. They're going to null cross them, which means that you've been arrested, but you'll never do time and you'll never have to stand trial for these charges. They're going to release you so that you can go and do the 25 to 40 in another state. Well, if you wanted to see a white man do the cabbage patch in the courtroom, that's what I did on that day. And so I call my attorney in the other state. He says, "How did it go up there on those grand jury indictment charges?" I told him. He said, "Man, that's incredible. Grand jury indictments never null cross you. They always convict you of something." He says, "Give me 10 minutes. I'll call you back." He calls me back. He says, "You're not going to believe this, but because you don't have a conviction there on cocaine or crack charges, this state cannot view you as a first-time felon. They have to look at you they can't view you as a mitigated felon. They have to look at you as a first-time offender. In this state, that does no longer carry 25 to 40. The most they can sentence you to is a mandatory 7 years in prison." Come on, somebody do the moonwalk for me real quick.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
So I went from 38 because I was reading the Word of God, because I obeyed it, because I was making these corrections in my life, and because I cried out for mercy and not justice. I'm looking at a mandatory 7, right? So I kiss my little boy goodbye. I kiss his mother goodbye. My son has an older sister, Sonia. I kiss her goodbye, and I'm now ready to go do my 7 years. And in my head and my heart, I'm just convinced I'm going to go in there and just work on becoming a better man. I'm not going to see my family for years because I'm being sentenced 5 states away from where they live. Well, when I walk into the prison that I'm processing at, I meet with the counselor. The counselor says, "We see here that you've been sentenced to a mandatory 7 years in prison." I said, "Yes, ma'am." They said, "Well, we have a problem." I said, "Yes, ma'am, what is it?" She says, "Well, the prisons are overcrowded in this state. And because of the overcrowdedness, your mandatory 7 is now being cut to 3.5 years.
Man. Yeah.
The Lord was just lining it up one piece at a time. The beauty for me is the first thing I did when I landed in prison was I started pursuing my education. I started taking correspondence courses that would graduate to UNC Chapel Hill. I ended up transferring to a prison that was near UNC Chapel Hill where they had professors who came into the prison and instructed us. I was able to excel. I had a 4.0 GPA in all of my coursework with UNC Chapel Hill. They then introduced me to be the only inmate that was able to go and do a student release at UNC Chapel Hill. The problem was UNC Chapel Hill did not want to have a convicted felon on their campus, so they denied me. So the people that were helping me out from vocation rehab, they went and they talked to another university, which is North Carolina Central University, which is an HBCU. And the admissions office there, Mrs. Rowland, God rest her soul, big, heavyset black woman, she said, "Absolutely, I want him at my school." There he I come. And they loved on me. They treated me well. I had a prison van that would drop me off every morning and pick me up every night. And I would spend my extracurricular time in the admissions office with Mrs. Rowland and her staff. And God has been faithful. God has been good. God has not made it easy, but he's made me much stronger as a result of it, and so I thank him for it.
My goodness, what a testimony.
Yeah.
And I feel like you didn't even really give us all the detail, but still, that was an amazing testimony. So let's fast forward now that you're out. As a convicted felon, not a lot of people are aware that so many of your rights are revoked. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the rights that were revoked from you and how it affected you directly?
Well, the 13th Amendment, and there's a great documentary by Ava DuVernay. It's incredible. If people haven't watched it, please go to Netflix and check it out. The 13th Amendment arose as a result of the Civil War as an anti-slavery amendment. And it says, that what it actually says is neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime, or no, hold on. It says in 1865, it abolished slavery in the United States. The 13th Amendment states that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction. Let me translate it from my experience. It states that person cannot hold any other person as possession unless they go to prison or unless they've been arrested of a crime. Once they have been arrested of a crime, according to the 13th Amendment, men can be placed back into a slavery environment, a slavery system, as a result or as a way of punishment for the crime that they have done. So the way that this has impacted me, because there's no way I could have had full understanding of that had I not lived it. But the hardest thing and the reason why this criminal justice reformation has to come is because when I got out of prison, I could not get a job. I mean, nobody would hire me. And while I'm in prison, I'm a 4.0 GPA student. Mm-hmm. Like excelling, I've always excelled at everything that I've done. And so when I get out, no corporation will hire me. Now, I understand why, because when I sit down to do the interview and I would do corporate interviews, I'd be in my third, fourth, and one corporation, fifth interview. I passed every interview with everybody. The question mark always was when I had to check that box. And people listening are not familiar, the box is on every employment form, and it asks, have you ever been convicted of a crime?
Right.
Now, here I am. I've been out of prison over 2 decades. I still have to check that box. Here's the problem, because my brother would tell me, he'd say, bro, why don't you just stop checking the box? Here's what you have to understand. I've worked so diligently and so hard to rebuild my name, to have character and integrity assigned to it, that if you hire me and then you find out later that I lied on my application, you have the right to terminate me immediately.
Right.
And so I'm in this conflict, which is a moral, ethical conflict of I've been reformed, I've been redeemed, I've changed my life, I'm now a productive, constructive part of society, but I have to lie on an application in order to have a chance to get hired at a corporation. And so the crazy thing for me was, because that was not a lane that was open to me, I had to go the route of, you know, basically hustling. I had to always hustle jobs. And so I worked for a couple of years in churches, which I became disenchanted because churches just wanted to have church. I wanted to impact people. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back into the prisons. I wanted to go back into the communities. I wanted to help the poor. I wanted to help the needy. I wanted to do stuff for the orphan and for the widow. And the church just wanted to have conferences. And so I became disenchanted. I left that environment. I ended up moving to Miami, Florida, where my brother was living at the time. He said, bro, look, I don't care what you do, but you got to get a job. And I knew what he was saying was right.
Mm-hmm.
It was, because it wasn't like I wasn't trying. But, you know, where do you want me to get a job? He said, man, go down to the nightclubs on South Beach. And I did. And I started working at one of the, you know, best nightclubs. It was absolutely one of the best nightclubs in Miami, South Beach at the time. And, you know, the way things went for me was I just stayed in prayer. And I can remember being in that nightclub with statues of Buddha and all these other Asiatic gods that were in there. And I can remember God telling me, pray. I just want you to pray. I put you here just to pray. And so I got to pray for all kind of entertainers and athletes and all of that kind of stuff while I was there, which is kind of neat. But one night Jennifer Lopez was coming, and I approached her bodyguard, and I said, hey, man, if you ever need a guy, just let me know. I didn't expect him to ever call. Well, something went sideways in Jennifer's life as it pertained to a relationship she had with Ben Affleck at the time. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you know, the next morning I got a phone call asking me to be at her house in an hour.
Wow.
And I said, an hour. I said, bro, I'll be there in 30 minutes. What are you talking about? So what that did was it opened up an avenue for me to go and start working and doing security and then eventually bodyguard work, and got to travel with her. She then married Mark Anthony, Got to travel on private jets, you know, to Spain. I went to 5 cities in Spain. I went to the Tenerife Islands off of the coast of Morocco in Africa. I went to South America, Central America. Coincidentally, I worked with Puff Daddy or P. Diddy, whichever you know him as. Mm-hmm. I worked for him as his personal driver security in Miami for 5 years. And at the end of that, you know, because of where I had come from, right, I came from this place of prison and desperation and hopelessness to now having this opportunity to travel and fly with world famous entertainers. And I was completely unfulfilled, totally unfulfilled, because God put something more inside of me and I knew it. And long and the short of it is I ended up meeting Stephen Baldwin, who's an actor, one of the Baldwin brothers. He had recently come to faith. Him and I became cool. I started traveling and doing some stuff with him in New York, Vegas, and then L.A. While in L.A., I met some famous skateboarder guys who were going into the prison to share faith in Christ with inmates. I said, I want to do that. And so I signed up. I flew from Miami to Oakland, California. The first prison that I ever shared my faith in was San Quentin, which is infamous. And I watched as 3,000 inmates were on the yard. I watched about 500 to 1,000 of them gather around me, and many of them afterward ran up to me crying and asking me if I will pray with them about specific needs with themselves, their family, their children, their wives, their mothers, their fathers. And I recognized that God had not given me celebrity bodyguarding as a career. He gave it to me as a platform. That was enough of a platform that people would be interested in hearing more about my story of how I came to faith in him. And so that's where most people miss it. Most people don't realize that God has already given us a platform. We just got to figure out what it is and how to use it.
Exactly. I talk a lot about the difference between a platform and a purpose. So can you just verbalize what you believe is your life's purpose?
Yeah, life's purpose. Interesting. So September 10th, 2006, a pastor in Washington, D.C. spoke a word over my life. I don't know where your listeners sit with prophecy. I'm half in, half out because there's so much cuckoo stuff that's out here. But I felt that this was a real true word for my life. And he said that God has given you a great heart for the poor. And he's going to position you between great wealth and great poverty. And riches are going to pass through you because you're going to know how to care for the needs of those that have lack. And the Lord will use you because he'll be able to trust you. Now, that was over 25 years ago. I had never heard my heart articulated by somebody else so clearly, so clearly. And so for me, that has always been a mapping point. So if I ever get too far away from that, I know that I'm probably not moving in the right direction. It's always going to be in the direction of how do I use my connections, my resources, my access to help hurting people get what they need from people that have what they need.
Right.
And so he's done that for me in a number of different ways. So what I would say is that for me is purpose. That for me is why I go see inmates who are obviously the poor and the needy and the hopeless. And I have to get I have to use my platform to be able to go and do that. So my platform serves my purpose as well as my purpose serving my platform.
Exactly. Which leads me to the prison reform. So if you can briefly tell me how you're using your platform and your purpose to contribute to the prison reform.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff that's happening right now. It's happening on both the liberal and the conservative sides. The conservative side is obviously President Trump's administration that has just passed something called the Second Chance Act, something like that. And then you have people like Meek Mill, who are kind of the face child of the liberal end of it, with people like Jay-Z and Michael Rubin of the Philadelphia 76ers really backing it and putting a lot of dollars behind it. The thing that I like to really point out is that while it's great that you have someone like a Meek Mill who can be the face child of this, his encounter is so unique that, you know, 99.9% of people are not going to have what he's been given. I mean, Jay-Z and Michael Rubin put $5 million behind investigating the judge that was keeping Meek Mill in prison so that they could get him out of prison because he was being falsely imprisoned, right? So that's bizarre. People don't have that. Because the 13th Amendment, as much as it is about race, and it is absolutely about race, it is a way that the government came up to control people who are black or minority. But in addition to that, it has been set up to control the poor. It has been set up because 99% of people that go to court who are poor have no representation. They just go in and plea bargain and end up getting sentenced to prison, whether they are guilty or not guilty. And so the goal here is that how do we bring to the attention of people today that if you do not allow me to get out of prison and get a job, I'm going to revert to some other way to survive and take care of my family. Now, here's the other part of it. The slave system that was brought to this country very early was very systemic in that the slave master would always take the husband of the family who was a slave, and they would emasculate him in front of his family. They would take him and strip him of all of his rights. They would embarrass him. They would whip and abuse him in front of his wife and children. Then if they wanted to take advantage of his wife, they would do so in front of him and their children. Then they would sell him off to another plantation, causing the man of the home not to be there and be emasculated in front of them. And that is horrific. I went from North Carolina Central University. I spent 2 years there, and then I transferred to Howard University. I had coursework that I did at Howard, the Black Experience since 1865. Incredible, 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 enlightening coursework that exposed me to things that are horrific. What I want to do is, although it's not as dramatic as what I just described, it's exactly what the 13th Amendment does to men when they take them out of their households, when they sentence them unfairly, when they leave them in prison because they don't have representation, when they're giving lengthy sentences to men to go to prison for nonviolent crimes, when you have the highest prison population in the country, when you have people that are sitting in prison for months and years because they had a dime bag of marijuana, which has now been legalized in many, many states across the country, all of this stuff has to be corrected. And if once I serve my time, you don't allow me to come back to my family. And let me explain to you how I've experienced this, Brittany. I could not go back where I got in trouble to live after I got out of prison. I was too high profile of a case, and I had police who were against me, but it was also a small town where there weren't many jobs. And I knew that if I had went back there, nor did I have a desire to go back there, but I knew if I had went back there, not only would I struggle, but I would struggle in front of my children, and I would struggle in front of their mother. And I knew that I would struggle in front of my family, and I did not want my family to see the struggle I had to endure because I couldn't get a fair shot when I got out of prison. Mm. I couldn't get an apartment in my own name. So here's the way the system works. Once you're out of prison, you have to get everything in your girlfriend's name or your mother's name, which emasculates the male in front of his family.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this complete system of emasculation. And yes, it does happen to blacks and minorities. But it happens to everybody. And I'm here to tell you it happened to me.
Mm.
And I want to bring attention to it. I want to be able to use my story. I want to be able to use my struggles. I want to be able to partner with other people, other organizations who care about this, because you have men that want nothing more than to get a car in their name, to get a house in their name, to be able to work a job in their name, and to not have to check the box and lie on an application, because that's going to disqualify them from being able to take care of their family.
Right.
And so these are the reasons why prison reform has to be moved to a forefront. It has to be something that is addressed because we have the highest prison population in the world.
What are things that we can do as citizens to contribute to the prison reform?
Well, I think like everything else, right? It's what people get behind. It's what people become passionate about. And one of the things for me is, you know, I travel into the prisons and I've spoken in prisons for the last 10 years all over the country. The thing I share with them is, listen, I need you to do right. I need you to do right.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm out here trying to make things better for people like us and you're still doing wrong, you're abusing what I'm trying to help us get approved. Right. So now you have people that are pointing fingers saying, well, yeah, you may have done well. But look at these other 90 guys who haven't. Look at these other 90 guys who are committing crimes, these other 90 guys who won't get it right, who won't do right. Mm-hmm. And so the whole thing is trying to get people to awaken. And I think that the prison population is a place of great awakening. It was a place of great awakening for me, and I know many, many others. And so if we can really – the other part of this, which is systemic, is that prisons really aren't rehabilitative, right? Prisons is where most people go. Malcolm X had said it's where people go to learn to become better criminals. Why? Because you're hooked up with other people, and you just refine your ability to be a criminal.
Wow.
But if people are able to take the track that I was able to take, and here's what's a pity, I'm one guy. There were three guys in my educational program that I went through while I was in prison, three. And one of them got out and the other one got transferred, and I was the only one that got to participate in the college release program. But you're talking about an entire prison population that spends all of their days doing nothing but playing cards, watching television, and wasting their day. Because nobody is giving attention to, you know, I'm reminded biblically of David. David finds himself in a cave with a bunch of derelicts. They were indebted. They were distressed. And David goes in and spends time with these men, and they become the mighty men of God. And this is key because this is what our prisons are. But we don't have money to back programs. Like, nobody pays me to go into the prisons. Nobody's bankrolling me to go into the prisons. Mm-hmm. And I believe I have begged people, please back these projects so that we can go in here and help these men and women who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And people don't get behind it. Churches don't get behind it. And so this is something where, unless it's something where people say within their own community, within their own church, hey, listen, this is something that has impacted my family, it's impacted my community, and I want us to do something about it. Until those things happen, it won't get the gravity that it needs.
Wow.
Prison reform. Prison reform. So the good news is my son is now 30 years old. Mm-hmm. He's doing incredibly well. He's living in Los Angeles, California, and we are working on our relationship, and it is not easy. We don't have a normal life. I couldn't provide him with a normal father with a stable 9-to-5 lifestyle. And so it's been he's had to adapt to the hurdles that I have had in life, and he's been gracious to do it. But it's not come without challenges on both of our part. There's stuff that he's needed from his dad that I haven't been able to give to him because I haven't been in a better position to be able to do it at times in his life. You know, so the point is that this whole system of whether you want to call it slavery, whether you want to call it prison, these systems are set up to tear families apart, especially those that don't have the resources to plug back into society, to produce and provide for their family, and to give them a stable life.
Wow. I'll tell you one thing. In this one session, you've schooled me a ton on the prison reform, and I think it's sad that a lot of us don't really understand why it's so important and why we really should get behind it. So thank you for sharing your passion, your purpose, your testimony. Lastly, if you don't mind, I would like for you to close us out by sharing with us a word of encouragement or empowerment on pursuing your purpose and persevering, just anything that's on your heart that can carry us through the rest of the week.
Well, what I'd like to say, Brittany, and again, thank you for allowing me to be on your show, is that life is not promised that it would be easy. And I don't believe that faith starts when we believe for something. I don't believe faith starts until we begin to question what we believe. It's at that point that we then have to activate and make a decision. It's easy to believe for something when everything is going well. Uh-huh. The difficulty comes when the challenges set in. And there's a word that has been a blessing to me, and I'm going to try to remember it off the top of my head for the sake of time right now. But the word is in Psalms 105. I believe it's verses 17 through 19. And it talks about when God wanted to set when God wanted to provide for his people, meaning Israel. They were stranded. They were in a famine. And it says that he put this young man named Joseph in shackles. And while he was in shackles, it says that Joseph was tested by the word that was spoken over him. Now, that's not going to hit and impact immediately. But as you think on it, everything that God has put us here to be and do, it's going to be tested. We are going to be tried by the word that God has spoken over us. And this is the reason why, if you have true prophecy spoken over your life, if it's been prophesied that you're going to do great and amazing things, you better believe you're going to have great and amazing tests. And you're going to have to be challenged by them, and you're going to have to find faith in the midst of them. And when absolutely nothing is going the way that you expected it to go, you're going to have to cry out to God, and you're going to have to get rid of your bad attitude and get rid of your feelings. And I know this because I've had to do it. And you're going to have to work on getting yourself to a place that where you believe what God has said over you and about you more than you believe what's happening in and through you.
Mm-hmm.
And so standing on the word of God, God showed me myself when I went to that jail cell as a 22-year-old young man. He showed me standing in front of thousands of people speaking. And I said, no way, I'm never doing that. The problem was I thought I was going to have to do it then. I didn't have the experience on board then to have confidence to stand and speak. But when God takes you through hell, and when you live through the wilderness, and when you understand how to make food out of a loaf of bread, when you figure out how to struggle and survive, when you don't know how you're going to pay the rent, and you figure it out, and somehow you make it, it's when you come out the backside of it that God says, are you still going to serve me even when you don't have enough?
Mm.
And this goes back to the book of Exodus, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt. It says that they murmured and complained. Why did God bring us out here to die? And that's the question. That's where faith starts. Faith starts when you are far enough out in the wilderness in your life experience that God's now not showing up and he's not answering the prayers. And you're asking yourself, why did you bring me out here just to let me die? And that's when our faith kicks in and we make a decision. Lord, whether you provide for me in the wilderness or not, I know that you're going to get me through this. Lord, whether you are in the fire with me or not, I know that you're going to get me through this. And so I just want to encourage people, if you're going through hell, don't sit down. Don't stall there. Get yourself back up and keep going until you get through it, because God's going to be there waiting for us when we get there. In Jesus' name.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Faith and Fame with Brittany Q. Hill. Be sure to subscribe and make sure to rate us 5 stars on iTunes. See you next week.